Fresh tape, fresh tape, new tape, fresh tape.
This is a conversation with Dr. Kenneth R. Clark, the psychologist, in New York City, April 7th. Just to plunge in, Dr. Clark, let me read what supposedly is a quote from Mr. Lamerson on this school problem in New York. I would rather see it, the public school system, destroyed than not conform to his timetable, and added, quote, maybe it has run its course already, the public school system.
You would want me to comment on
that?
Yes,
yes. Well, out of context, you see.
Yes. Well, the first comment I'd make, obviously, is that this is an unfortunate statement. And I have a feeling that if Mr. Glamison were given an opportunity to retract it, he would. Obviously, no one would benefit from the destruction of the public school system in New York City or anywhere else in the country, for that matter. And certainly, Negroes could not possibly benefit from the destruction of the public school system. My feeling is that this was one of those impulsive statements which men often make in the heat of battle, and it should not be taken seriously. And I'm convinced that Mr. Glamison would not take that statement seriously now. In fact, if he were given an opportunity, I think he would take it back.
It corresponds, I suppose, to one pole of feeling, or one aspect of feeling is bound to be to arise in such matters. The Samson in the temple psychology.
Yes, except that I don't take that kind of statement seriously. It's obviously not a statement upon which one can base a reasonable plan of action or a program for social change. As I understand what the Negro is doing in America today, he is not asking for institutions to be destroyed. He's asking that these institutions be strengthened by including him within them. And I think we have to make a distinction between emotional statements and sometimes hysterical slogans which people will use in the heat of battle, and sound judgments which are the basis for the long-term program.
May I test this now and
sure.
See how this is coming on? There's always a problem, isn't there, in every mass movement or even things more modest than mass movements, how you relate the emotional drives to a reasoned program. Isn't that always a problem in all movements?
Yes, and particularly when one has to face the fact that our society does not move initially on the basis of rational, factual, or ethical appeals. It is one of the most disturbing things to me to observe that emotional, irrational appeals are much more likely to be effective in bringing about initial concern with an obvious social problem, you see. For example, and you mentioned Reverend Glamison. Well, a number of people have been working on the New York City public school problem for years, for the past 25 years. There have been a citywide committee on Harlem schools that was in existence when I was in college, headed by Algernon Black. During the past 10 years, a number of us from the Urban League and from other citizen groups in New York have been collecting data and trying to present to the Board of Education a sound, factual, basis for increasing the efficiency of the schools in Harlem and in other disadvantaged areas of the city. Well, actually nothing happened. I mean, our reports were accepted graciously and in effect filed and forgotten. We set up a series of conversations with the superintendent of schools and board of education members, but the bureaucracy ignored a factual, rational approach to the diagnosis of the problem and to the attempts at effective remedy. Well, Mr. Glamison comes into the picture, and he moves on a level of emotional impact. You know, he organizes people to boycott the schools, to make immediate demands, you see, or demands for immediate change. Well, it's an important reality that one must face the fact that Mr. Glamison has had more impact within the past 6 months on the Board of Education of the City of New York than all of the previous years of patient, you know, reasoned, objective, factual study of this situation.
Let's make a shift to another aspect of that same problem. Clearly, he's made the impact. And clearly, this has been a dramatization of an intolerable situation.
Right.
Let's put it that way. What about rational and irrational solutions, however?
Well, that's another problem. I don't think there is any such thing as a meaningful, irrational solution to a problem. What I'm
not
trying
a solution, but what passes as a solution.
No, I think that effective solutions have to be based upon facts, have to be based upon reason, have to be based upon logic, logistics, and things of that sort. But I don't think, in looking at this society from the perspective of a Negro and a psychologist, the thing that really appalls me about this society is that one does not get to the point of even seeking the rational solutions for long-standing social ills, and maybe I should be even more specific, racial injustices, unless these injustices are dramatized for the public more often than not by irrational or non-rational methods and techniques. Now, the danger, of course, is the possibility of confusing the methods and techniques that are appropriate and effective for dramatizing the ills with methods and techniques that are necessary for the long-term planning and resolution of the problems. I think one of the difficulties with the civil rights struggle today is that such confusion occurs in certain communities. I think we are in a danger of having that kind of confusion here in New York City.
You mean on both sides of the fence?
Right. Yes. I think that the Negro people understandably can believe that dramatic methods of protest, because they are effective in bringing into the consciousness of the people the nature of the problem, that these same methods will be effective in resolving the problem. Excuse me.
In that connection, what do you think of the busing proposals, the particular proposals, and the possibility of other more rational ones if you don't approve of these?
Well, there are two forms of busing proposals. The one that is in operation now, where Negro youngsters and Puerto Rican youngsters from ghetto areas of the city are transported to receiving schools in middle-class white areas. This is the open enrollment plan. It's interesting that in the initial stages of this plan, when it was first proposed and tried out, there was opposition, a tremendous amount of opposition in certain areas of the city, in Queens, for example.
Serious opposition?
Serious opposition,
I knew
yes.
some, I didn't know how much.
Yeah, there was serious in Glendale, Queens. There was organized, prolonged opposition to bringing in of Negro children into, quotes, the white schools, unquotes. The Board of Education persisted, however, and continued the open enrollment program so that there is no problem now on that. The present proposal, which is the basis of controversy and difficulty, suggested not by the board, but by some of the civil rights groups, is that white children be transported into the ghetto schools. My own reaction to this is that this is unrealistic, as not likely to be implemented, and is likely just to be a bone of meaningless controversy. I think it's unrealistic because I'm convinced that the bulk of white parents of children in the public schools would not permit their children to be transported into ghetto areas in New York for purposes of integration, or for that matter, for any purpose. I think their reasoning has some basis in fact. The schools in the Negro communities are woefully inferior. They are so inferior that no child should be required to attend them. The Negro parent, the working class Negro parent, unfortunately has no choice, see, except to send his child to these schools, and I think this is criminal. The white parent does have a choice. If the Board of Education were to force white parents to make this move, the middle-class white parents would escape either by accelerating the flight to the suburbs or by sending their children to private schools or to parochial schools. Rather than facilitating integration, I think that type of program at this time and at this level of development of race relations and racial attitudes in Americans would accelerate the segregation problem. It would make the public schools almost totally a minority group and poor whites.
It would accentuate the class split too, wouldn't it? As well as the racial split. Is that true?
I'm convinced of that, yes. That it would, that the public schools would become exclusively, predominantly, if not exclusively, minority group and lower class whites.
Is this true? I understand from various sources that more and more middle class Negroes are sending their children to private schools too.
This is quite true.
This split is going on very rapidly.
Yeah, one of the ironic things about the leadership of the present public school fight in New York is that the top leaders of this fight, Reverend Glamison and some of his top associates, have their own children in private schools.
So I understand.
But I would consider this as much a compliment to them as a criticism, because in effect what they are saying is that they are really fighting for the adequate and appropriate education, democratic education of all children, not just their own. But it is a fact that they, recognizing the inferiority of the schools which their children would be required to attend, are willing to make whatever sacrifices are necessary to send their own children to private schools.
That argument would cut both ways, wouldn't it? A white father or mother objecting to having the child sent to a Harlem school be using the same argument to himself that Reverend Glamison would be using.
Exactly. Exactly. And there would be no more basis on the face of it to accuse the white parent of racial prejudice than to accuse Reverend Galvanison of racial prejudice.
Or snobbery.
It could be for the white as much a reaction to the inferiority of the school as it is for the middle class Negro who refuses to send his children to the existing public schools.
That point is not often recognized, however, is it?
But it's no less real.
It's no less real. Yeah, I'm talking now about the way emotions operate, not about the way the reason operates.
Very true.
May I switch the topic a little bit? Years ago, I began to read Du Bois, and I was struck at the time by his stating and coming over and over again to the topic of the split in the Negro psyche, or this, or what he calls that split, the drive toward the mystique noire, toward the African heritage, toward the sense of a Negro culture here as well as else as from Africa, the sense of identity and commitment of a Negro culture as one pull, one pole of experience and one desire for development. The other, the exact opposite. They're moving into the Western European, American, Judeo-Christian tradition and absorbing and being absorbed into that as fully as possible, even with the possible consequence of the laws of, now this is extrapolating from him, of law in a sense, of racial identity at all, blood absorption. These are two separate impulses. Does this strike you as a psychologist as a real problem or not?
Certainly strikes me as another bit of evidence of Dr. Du Bois's shrewdness and his ability to anticipate and to see beneath the surface problems to the basic problems of race in America. As a psychologist, I'm convinced that Du Bois was correct. The Negro in America is ambivalent in his feelings about his place in the larger society and in his feelings about himself. It would have been a miracle if he could have adapted to the whole history of cruelty and oppression and come out of this with a positive, unalloyed, positive image of self or set of feelings about the society which has oppressed him in the context of a democratic ideology. The present form of this, and of course one of the things we ought to recognize right away is that Du Bois was one of the first Americans, Negro or white, to recognize the importance of Africa. Du Bois was talking about Pan-Africanism and the fact that Africa was going to be the significant area of the world in the latter part of the 20th century, as early as the beginning of the 20th century. He was saying this when other people barely knew what Africa was, or you know, when the average intelligent American image of Africa was largely that of a bunch of savages. Cannibals, Du Bois.
So was that of most Negroes, I understand.
That's right. That's right.
A place to send missionaries was
their concept of Africa.
Concept of Africa.
But as early as the first, second decade of the 20th century, Du Bois was pointing to Africa as a significant area of world concern.
Do you see any continuity, cultural continuity, of the American Negro with Africa?
Personally?
Do you see any, observe any?
No, personally, I don't. Personally, I think of Africa pretty much the way I think of Asia or Europe or South America. In terms of any conscious or cultural continuity between the American Negro and Africa, I think one has to, and to be realistic, one has to recognize that the American slave trade systematically sought to destroy any such continuity. The Africans were not permitted to be brought, well, they were not brought here and given the opportunity to continue any of their prior heritage.
There was no cultural entity called Africa anyway, was there? It was a mass of different cultures.
A mass of different cultures. From what I've read about the slave trade, the slave traders were not anthropologists. They didn't go over there trying to bring people from the same cultural unit into the American scene.
Have you read a book by Stanley Elkins called Slavery, published by Chicago a few years ago?
No, I haven't.
It deals with the psychological effects on the slave in America as compared to the psychological effects on the slave in other slave societies like Brazil or Cuba, as places.
I would suspect that maybe he would conclude that slaves in America were subjected to a more intense and effective degree of deculturation than the slaves in Brazil.
Also, the creation of the quotes of Sambo was worked out in a paternalistic treatment rather than, well, it's totally one, the owner controlled all, the state behind him, as opposed to the Central American or South American system where there's a Catholic culture where the priest could demand the sacrament of marriage. You can tend to maintain the family. Well, the state overseer who might be against, in theory anyway, the owner.
Yes.
And the question of slave revolt then comes up. Why were they so common in Catholic countries and so rare, despite West Africa, in America?
Yeah. Could it be also population difficulties or differences that in the West Indies, certainly the form of colonialization there was such that the population, white population, was never that much greater than the slave population, and with absentee ownership, which characterized the West Indian slavocracy and, to a lesser extent, the South American. This was the opposite in America, where you always had the whites in majority. And just the risk involved in revolt would be greater in a situation where there was a stable majority white population, in contrast to a economy where you had a relatively unstable absentee ownership and minority white population.
That would seem to be a fact in any case.
Yeah.
Though he centers most of his discussion on the matter of the psychological effect of the system in the United States.
Mm-hmm. I think part of that psychology involved the reality of numbers.
And the question of building up back as a corollary a Negro community or rebuilding one in the new context.
Yes.
But this bears on the question, doesn't it, of the achievement of the Negro in this generation and in some time before in achieving an identity.
Yes.
This is a question, not a statement. But if you take Elkins' theory, the problem of achieving an adequate self-image, a satisfactory identity, would be greater in America, despite certain superficial benefits of a Negro has had here, than it would be in other societies.
The problem of
establishing
a positive identity, yes. Yes, except that one can establish a an identity through protest. One
now, can, now.
Now, and I think if one looks at the Negro spirituals, one sees, or at least I think one could interpret the spirituals as attempts and struggles toward some kind of positive identity through protest, through hope, through a plaintive, anguished desire for a better lot. I mean, I can't buy totally the feeling that oppression destroys the identity surge of human beings. I think, for example, if one looks at the Jews, who have gone through much longer periods of oppression, cruelty, and barbarity, you sometimes get the feeling that the Jewish identity has as its nucleus, around which everything else clusters, the protest against oppression. You see, that the Jew sees himself as someone who exists because he has been oppressed.
He also had, at a differing degree anyway, a sense of a cultural continuity and knowledge of his history.
True. Well, the knowledge of his history was the knowledge of the series of oppressions, the series of difficulties that he has had with
also his other triumphs he had.
Triumphs, but I think the triumphs were always earlier.
Earlier, but they were there.
They were there as maybe the rock on which then the defeats and the oppressions could rest and be brought into a more positive kind of construct.
And this brings us to Malcolm X then, doesn't it?
How?
The creation of the past.
Well,
assuming it is to be spurious, I suppose what might be the real past.
Well, I don't know what is a real past for the American Negro. I think that Malcolm X is an example, or black nationalism, of which he is merely one form.
Yes,
is an example of the struggle to create a past. You know, I think, for example, when the Muslims call themselves true Muslims because this was the heritage of their forefathers, I'm not sure how much the reality they have here. I mean, I think this is real in the sense of a wish, real in the sense of a satisfying sort of fantasy.
Hilliard's fantasy, any historical record indicates that. Mohammedism came very little into Africa.
Right. If one were to be bluntly realistic and logical about this, it would seem to me that the American Negro's past functionally begins with the slave trade. You see, this is the only verifiable continuity that he has. Now, obviously, he has something before that, but in terms of the meaning of his present experience and existence is to be understood in terms of the 17th century events, catastrophic events, I mean, disruption of whatever he had in Africa. Did not carry over here.
Yes.
He was uprooted. He was literally snatched away from whatever past he had and had to begin anew.
Now, psychologically, what weight do you put on this fact, say, on the Negro situation as opposed to that of, say, the Jew or the Nisi or any other minority group which brings to America a form tradition and has a, quote, glorious past it knows about, you see?
Well, obviously that type of advantage provides some stability of self, stability of the group. It provides a a rallying point for the individuals who comprise the group. The Negro's rallying point has had to be shared oppression, you see. He has had to build a sense of group, a sense of belongingness out of the common experience, and the common experience in terms of this new culture. Namely, he was oppressed in this new culture. He had a humanity. He had the human reactions against oppression. And he had the human desire to become free of the oppression, and he has translated his desire to be free of oppression as also meaning to be incorporated into this system without regard to his color, because he sees himself as an integral part of this society. He helped to build it. He has contributed as much as any other group who comprise America, and more than most.
Excuse me, Bill. This is the end of tape 1 of the conversation with Dr. Kenneth Clark. Proceed on tape 2.